I'm Buzz Knight, the host of the Taking a Walk Music History on Foot podcast. Follow us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Please share this episode with a friend. Leave us a review as well at Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can also sign up for our newsletter at takingawalk.com. You can leave us comments about guests that you'd like to hear. Maybe you'd even like to suggest yourself as a guest. Today we have a member of Rock Royalty. John Anderson is the iconic founding member and lead singer from the English progressive rock band Yes. This is a band that has been a soundtrack certainly to my life and to so many of you. And so glad to take a walk down music history with John Anderson from Yes. We'll also talk about upcoming projects for him in 2023. So welcome to Taking a Walk with John Anderson. Well, John Anderson, I'm truly honored and grateful to have you on Taking a Walk. You've been a large part of my life for so many years.
Excellent, Buzz.
So when was that moment in time when you first realized that you were a musician, that you were stuck in this business? At what moment was that?
When I stopped working on the farm with my brother, because my brother and myself, we worked on this farm about a mile or so away from the home in Accrington, northern England. And we get up every morning, 5:30, and all weathers, you know, snow, rain, or shine, whatever. And we get on a bus and go up to the farm. And we got on the farm, and we go out and start milking the cows and shoveling a lot of cow poop, and singing. We sang all the time together because we were fans with the Everly Brothers. This is 1958-59. And then Buddy Holly came along, and so we sang Buddy Holly, and then what's the guy with the dark glasses?
Roy Orbison.
What a guy. And so basically, you know, my brother had a band, you see, and they were called the Warriors, or sometimes the Warriors. And there were two singers. There was my brother and a guy called I can't remember his name, but he wanted to be a hairdresser, so he left the band. So my brother said, why don't you join the band? You know, we can do Everly's, and I'll do Elvis Presley, and you can do Roy Orbison. And so I said, yeah, let's do that. Screw this working hard on the farm. I wanted to get out and tour the world, not knowing that it would happen, but, you know, you wanted to. And that's, you know, that's when I started to realize being in a band was more fun than shoveling a lot of shit.
Some might say it was a different version of shit you had to shovel at times, right?
Well, I don't want to go there. but it was a breakthrough for me to, you know, to realize that we could travel. We had a van and we traveled and all over England and Scotland and Wales. And eventually we went to Germany to follow the Beatle Trail. Now, the Beatle Trail was very simple, that you play in a club 8 hours a night, and then you go 2 weeks there, and then you go to Munich, then you go to Hamburg, Copenhagen, back to Köln. So that's what we did for about 6 months. And by then, we were frazzled. My brother left the band, and I'm with the guys. And I think I took a lot of, what was it called? Acid. Just like everybody else did. You know, the Beatles had Sgt. Pepper and Revolver and everything. So music was going badoo, you know. And that's how I stayed in the whole idea. Because, you know, I just had a problem that I kept hearing music in my head, like big time ideas. And I go to see the guys in the bedroom next door. I say, come on, guys, it's 10 in the morning. Let's go and rehearse. And they would say, F off, John. And for the second morning, I went in and said, guys, we've got to rehearse. Come on, guys, we could be a great band. F off, they all said, in unison. And so I packed my bags and left the band. And that was probably the best thing I ever did. It was kind of frightening, but I did it.
Do you remember the first time you heard Sgt. Pepper and what your reaction was?
Hamburg. I was in Hamburg, and my friend Brian Chatton was a keyboard player. He had a hat with a balloon hanging from it that with a hot air in it. So the balloon was up in the air like that. And we were actually singing all the songs because we'd spent all night singing them. And that's all we did all for about a week. We sang every song, every word, and smoked a lot of marijuana. And a few tabs of acid, you know, come on. It was rock and roll.
So that whole London scene in 1968 was a hotbed of real creativity, right? Everything seemed to, all styles seemed to blend together musically. There was a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Can you talk about some of those styles then as Yes was first formed?
Well, I think the great music that I was hearing at that time was Buffalo Springfield, the Beach Boys, great recordings. Zappa, oh my God, you know, it was like, and then I got turned on to jazz by, I met Keith Jarrett. he was 18, I think, at that time, young guy. And then I started listening to a lot of very various music at that time. And that's when I went to London and I met Chris. And we were sort of like brothers right away. And we both had the same intention, and we both loved Simon and Garfunkel. The album had just come out, Your Bridge Over Troubled Waters, and just great new music. And that was London. And it was all like that in New York and LA, everywhere in the world. We weren't alone with the idea that music was like an open door, because I was probably by then about 26. I thought I was too old to be a pop star. So I just wanted to write some music, and I started studying Stravinsky and Sibelius, and that's changed my life, you know. I've just been walking over the hills and far away around where I walk every morning, listening to Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto by this lovely lady called Martha, I can't remember her last name, Argonaut. She's an incredible performance, and I've been listening to it for the last month, every day. You know, every day you keep learning. You know, you learn structure, and that's what I was doing with Chris and the Yes. When Yes started, all I could think about was structure, and let's just do this kind of an idea, that kind of idea. And happily, at that time, everybody listened.
You had a description of a band that you saw that's pretty incredible that really influenced you, called the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And your review of that, seeing John McLaughlin and band there, I love it how you said after seeing Mahavishnu that you couldn't breathe. It was such an experience.
Unbelievable. It was like everything rolled into one. It was like Zappa meets this band meets that band, and all of a sudden this band on stage, and they didn't have a singer. He just played this music, which was a miracle in a way. Me and Chris stood there, and we'd had the same experience about 6 months earlier with King Crimson in London, watching them do their first show. They played the whole album in the court of the Crimson King. And it was magnificent because they just learned it, just recorded it, and that was their first performance in this club. But seeing Mahavishnu was like another level. And it just, I think it sort of opens up your state of consciousness, you know, about music. And that time I was lucky to meet Vangelis and start working with Vangelis. And that was another stepping stone to musical sort of discovery.
Well, so when you were working at the Marquee Club, that was a place that you encountered a lot of people, as they would roll through and play there, everybody from Pete Townsend and some other notorious characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of them was Jimi Hendrix, who I think you encountered.
Everybody encountered Jimi Hendrix.
What did you guys do together when you hung out?
Me? I just nothing. I was stunned. I actually saw him for the first time in Munich, and he came back to the house that I was living in. I was living in the closet. These two lovely girls that were looking after me because I was out of my brain. And he sat down and smoked a joint with me, and he didn't say anything. He didn't have to say anything. He just performed on stage like a god messiah from another world, you know. And then I met him again. He got up and performed with Rassan Roland Kirk in a jazz club in London for an hour. Spontaneous, and that was my first real taste of pure jazz, you know.
Wow. So with stimulants you encounter Jimi Hendrix. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. He'd been there and back a dozen times, you know. That kind of guy that, you know, he knows who he is, what he does.
So in terms of these major influences, the Beatles as an example, Simon and Garfunkel as an example. So Yes would then go on in those two instances to honor those artists by covering their music. Can you talk about those two amazing examples of the tribute Yes did to those artists with the great music that you put out?
Well, it was only we went on tour when we first had our first album. We went on tour with gosh, I'm going to forget his name. That'd be terrible. Freedom. He had a big song called Freedom.
Well, Richie Havens.
Richie Havens, yeah. So Richie Havens and his two guys who were with him were magnificent. They would put on such a great show every gig. And there was a song called No Experience Necessary. And I said, come on, we've got to do this in honor of Richie, man. What a beautiful guy. And that's what we did. And I remember we used to do, as an encore, we used to do You Tell Lies Thinking I Can't See. You Can't Cry Because You're Laughing at Me. I'm Down.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that next spring.
I love that. But you also did Every Little Thing, too.
Every Little Thing, yeah. You reminded me. God, yeah. I think we were just searching for what to rehearse. You know, we'd rehearse a couple of ideas me and Chris had written. Chris had written one. I had a couple of more ideas. I think it took a little time for us to tour together and get to know each other better with at that time, it was Tony Kaye and Peter Banks and Bill Bruford. You know, it's funny because when we first started rehearsing with Chris's band, the drummer had left to get a gig in. He had a gig in France, and I said, "Why is he leaving the band? That's first day. You know, we haven't even started." He said, "Well, he's getting paid." And I thought, "Oh yeah, I get it." That's when we got Bill Bruford.
And then you would do this amazing version of America as well. What a amazing song, and what a great version that Yes did.
Yeah, I remember Pete, we said we're going to do America, and then we didn't see Pete for a day. He came another day later, and he started playing which was a great part of the song itself. You know, I think that was it. But I know Keith Emerson had done it on keyboards like crazy, wild. I mean, that whole West Side Story was a boon for musicians because it was just so beautifully done. Great songs.
So the first tour was quite a bunch of bands together. The first tour was The Who, Rod Stewart and Small Faces, Joe Cocker, Yes, and The Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
Yeah, Arthur Brown. He would sing Fire. He had this sort of crown that was that gas lights in, and he'd light his head up, and all the fire would come out of his head. It was a great show. Everybody went on for 10 minutes except The Who. They played as long as they want because they were The Who. And Pete Townshend actually spoke to me on the last gig. He said, he came up behind, I was watching Joe Cocker on stage. And I met Joe Cocker when he was 16. It's a lovely story, which is in my memoirs, the story. And so Peter, a very tall guy, stands behind me and we're watching Joe, and he said, "John?" And I thought, Pete's talking to me. "John, your band is very good. I just want to let you know, your band is very good." And I kept thinking, Pete Townshend is talking to me. I can't believe it. And then he said, "I'm doing an album about a blind, deaf, and dumb guy. What do you think about that?" And I said to myself, "Pete Townshend is talking to me." I didn't know what to say. You know, what do you say to that? And then Tommy came out, and that was just extraordinary, you know.
Did all the bands on a tour such as that, did everybody get along? Was there peace and harmony on the tour?
A lot of drinking. In those days, a lot of drinking and a little bit of marijuana. Yeah, everybody got on well, you know. Yeah.
No issues.
No. That came later. You know, that came later in the dark days.
Yeah. So when you think of favorite venues that you've played with Yes, whether it be big stadium venues or smaller venues, what are some of your favorite places that you still enjoy playing?
Well, of course, you know, no matter where you play, the audiences are great. There's so many places that we played over the years with Yes. Magical, very magical times. And I reflect on that when I'm on tour. I actually love small theaters. I played my solo show in New York at the B.B. King Little Club, yeah, around the corner on 5th Avenue, 42nd Street, whatever. They were great shows, you know. And then we do Madison Square Gardens with Yes, and what the hell? All these wonderful people, 20,000 people for 5 nights, and you go, I can't believe this is happening, you know? So you have, you know, in life, you know, you have extremes. So, you know, now I'm more happy just to tour. I've been touring with these young teenagers, the Academy of Rock. Paul Green, who invented School of Rock, has the Academy of Rock, and we've toured last August, which was just incredible fun, because I said to them, why don't we do, you know, Close to the Edge, guys, you know, and they all said, okay, did you started doing it, you know, it's like, they didn't argue, they just said, okay, we'll do that, you know, and they were just brilliant people, young people, very wonderful, and you get the chance to do that in a lifetime, you know, we did it 20 years ago, with the School of Rock, when it was the School of Rock. And I've done it a couple of years now with the Academy of Rock, and we're going on tour next summer, Europe, with Academy of Rock kids, and I feel like a kid when I'm with them until we do a selfie. We do a selfie, and I say, who's that old guy? It's me.
It looks the fun looks so contagious at the School of Rock events.
Yeah. Because, you know, they're not beaten up yet. Hopefully they'll never get beaten up emotionally about this crazy business that we live in, you know. And survival is all down to music. If you can get your next level of consciousness about music, that's a survival thing. And it makes you want to just make more music, whether it reaches people or not, is not the point. It's just making new music. And it was only about, gosh, it was 15 years ago when MP3s came up in the computer. You could use an MP3 and work with people around the world, you know. And I put an advert on my Facebook saying, musicians wanted, send a minute of your music, and if I like it, I'll get back to you. And I got about 100 people over a period of a year or so. And I got back to about 20 of them, 25 of them, and I'm still in touch with them because they were very, really talented, and they understood that they could create music and I would sing something that I would never sing with anybody else because it's them, because they are this music. And I met so many wonderful people over the years via the internet. So that's an interesting idea, that music should never stand still in your state of consciousness. You got to next level, next thing. I got to say, I'm going to sing Rachmaninoff's Third. I started writing lyrics to it because they're beautiful melodies, you know. And I thought, well why not? I'll probably write some lyrics to Rachmaninoff's Third Piano. Keep me out of trouble.
Music really is a healing force, isn't it, John?
Yeah, for sure. I remember as a kid, you know, I'd sit by the radio, where the radio stood on the floor, and I'd sit by it and I'd listen. And the things that I remember are Vaughan Williams music and Holst, Planet Suite, Mars. Used to freak me out as a kid. And then you listen to such beautiful orchestral music. And then, of course, as I said earlier, you know, you start listening to very American music. A lot of rock and roll is, the essence is American. It's kind of, because where I was listening to was old, they called it skiffle in England. And it was actually songs from country and western. So the country and western were the birth of rock and roll. I don't know how it happened, but there was a certain element of whiskey or something like that that get the drummer to, you know, really stick to it, you know, bass stick to it. And Chet Atkins, what an incredible guitar player. Brilliant. So all that stemmed from American energy. And of course, R&B came from American. So we sort of mishmashed everything, I think, and it's kind of cool as well.
So we have this mutual friend, Lee Abrams, who is a legendary consultant, inventor, innovator, and he certainly was gracious to connect us. Talk about what Lee Abrams means to the band Yes and to you personally.
Well, it's kind of a crazy story, but I think Lee will enjoy this, is that he used to come and hang around the band with a couple of other, three other guys, and we'd see them in Miami, or we'd see them in Chattanooga, or see them in New York, or there they are again. It's that guy again with all his friends. So we got to know each other, and he hung out like a fan of the band, and he was very interesting guy, but I never really connected with him closely. Chris did. Chris and him got into a whole world together for a while. And then strange things happened, but I really got into the idea. I've been listening to, I've said this many times, but I've been listening to Sibelius's Seventh Symphony, which is a glorious piece of music. And I was on tour doing some, can't remember which tour it was, but I was definitely Fragile. It was a Fragile tour. And I was listening to this music, and then I put it on, and then after a while I listened to it, and then it stopped. And I'd look at the cassette, and it was like it said 26 minutes long. The Seventh Symphony is only 26 minutes long. And up until then, I've been listening to symphonies that were always in three parts. First, second, and third movement. But this was the first 26-minute piece that held my state of mind. And I just went, wow, that's amazing. And at that time, around America, we were playing a lot of colleges. And the college radio was FM radio. And they would play the hell out of, Starship Trooper, which is like 7 minutes long, where any other record radio station would play anything under 4 minutes, John. You know, 3 minutes 33, it's perfect. So I really made me a bit confused that there we were making Heart of the Sunrise. It's a piece of music, you know. I'm sorry, it'll never get heard on the radio, though. And so I thought, wait a minute. I found radio, that's the key. And I got together with Steve. I said, Steve, why don't we just do this music and we'll make it into a long form 20-minute piece of music. And then he said, I've got this idea. He goes, close to the end, round by the corner. And I sang, down at the end, round by the river. Because I've been reading Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, who found a spiritual energy down by the river. So we sketched out, during the course of the Fragile tour, we sketched out an idea for Close to the Edge. And interestingly enough, we started recording it, and Chris was on board, and Bill loved it. Everybody loved it, and the idea of it. And, well, we're going to just do Close to the Edge and two other songs. That's all it is. We've got FM radio all over America, you know. Meanwhile, behind the scenes in America, Lee Abrams came up with an idea. AM radio, you've got 40 songs to play in the space of whatever, and that's what we're going to do from now on, all over America. So by the time we released Close to the Edge, there was nowhere to, anyway, there was no FM radio. So it was like, Lee Abrams, you naughty boy. But then, you know, a few years ago, we bumped into each other on tour with the kids, I think it was, and 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And, you know, he's a lovely guy. And he's like my guide to what's happening in the world on many different levels. He's such a smart guy. So me and Jane, we just love the guy. We go out for dinner whenever we're in Chicago. But he sends me a weekly update of what's happening in the world. And he's right on the money there, is that we're sort of going the wrong way on every kind of level. That one of the craziest things that hit me about a month ago was watching with my grandkids, I was watching children's TV, and it's pretty wild and crazy, but then there's these adverts that are just aimed at the kids who are just waking up to life, and they're dangerous. They're very dangerous advertising. It's very dark and dangerous. I don't like it. And then, you know, we all know that the media is just making money because that's all they're interested in. They don't care what the advert's about. Sort of thing. And that's been a very dangerous position to figure out, that how can we move forward consciously if we're teaching our kids to go and buy something they don't really need that much? But it's like materialism, isn't it? And if materialism, and this was taught to me by a wonderful guy called Long Walker, a beautiful Native American guy who walked the length of America to ask for justice for the treaties that were never kept. Anyway, he said, young people, they're caught up in the materialistic world, and they'll never come back. They'll get lost in the materialistic world. And it's nothing to do with Madonna.
Yeah, right on. Well, Lee is a Sherpa to where we are in the present and where we're headed in the future.
Yeah, I think it would be good if, you know, stick him on TV. Come on, you know. Come on, Lee. Put on a show.
So in closing, I would like to get your reflections on the loss of Jeff Beck.
Oh, God. It was only a couple of months ago, I was listening to Jeff Beck. I'd seen him perform live. I'd seen him with the Yardbirds, and I'd seen him in London. And he was such a character that I could never speak to him at all. You know, he just got that look about him. Don't fuck with me. But man, he could play guitar like nobody. I never heard anybody play like that. And a lot of people discovered how to do it. brilliant artist, and it's just natural that eventually they have to go home, you know, like we all have to, and that's okay. Same with Alan, you know, he was my best man, you know, Alan White. Yep. But, you know, eventually he had to go home. And same with Chris, you know. So people keep heading in that direction. I think it's just the next world. It's another world. It's another, not this world, it's the next world. And that's what I sing about quite a lot these days, that we're living in a very transitional world. And we don't need to look very far to understand the next world. I think all you have to do is sit very quietly and listen to the birds sing. Ta-da! And that's my final word.
Thank you for the joy that that you continue to give us. Good luck on School of Rock or anything else you have up your sleeve and in this year.
This year I'm doing the Band Geeks in April. Come and see the Band Geeks and John Anderson doing epics and classics. The Band Geeks, somebody sent me a tape of them performing Yes songs in their studio. And I thought, wait a minute, they sound just like the record. Not just like the record. And a year ago I got in touch with the bass player, Richie, who said, Richie, you're crazy. You're playing Yes songs exactly like they were recorded. And he said, yeah, that's what we do. I said, well, it's amazing. Why don't we go on tour? With you? I said, yeah, with me. We could go on tour and do, you know, the classics and the epics. Because I've always wondered, nobody's going to play the epics like they could be played. And he said, thank you. I said, okay, Richie. We should do it. And we actually have been rehearsing yesterday. And they sound really, really good. So it's going to be a great show for anybody who loves Yes. And we're going to be touring the East Coast in April. And then probably later in the year, the West Coast. But very much later, like December, January, something like that.
Never a dull moment for you, John Anderson.
No, I've got to get on with the next project. I was, and that's it. I'm going to sing the melodies from Rachmaninoff's Third Piano.
I love it. Well, I hope next time we won't be virtual taking a walk, and then we could actually take a walk in person. But I feel like it was just about there with you.
Buzz, where do you live?
I live outside of Boston, John.
Well, come and see the show.
You better believe it. I will be there.
I'll get you tickets, and you can backstage meet and greet. But we don't do meet and greet these days because the COVID's coming back. No, I can't get into that. Well, it's not coming back. Don't worry. It's okay. It's
just... So everything's going to be all right. I'm very grateful, John, for everything. Thank you for being on.
Take care, Buzz.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.